Good evening and welcome to tonight's Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program, brought to you from the Cubberly Theater in Palo Alto. My name is Dan Weiss. It's my pleasure to introduce James Fallows, national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly and author of China Airborne. James studied American history and literature at Harvard University and also served as editor of the Harvard Crimson. He later studied economics at the University of Oxford, where he was a Rhodes Scholar. James also spent 2 years as the chief speechwriter for President Jimmy Carter, the youngest person ever to hold that position. He began writing for The Atlantic in 1979 in Washington, D.C., and later moved to Tokyo, Kuala Lumpur, Shanghai, and Beijing. James is the author of 10 books and a frequent contributor to NPR's Morning Edition. In 2009, he became the regular news analyst for NPR's Weekend, All Things Considered, and a year later, won an Emmy for the documentary series On the Front Lines, Doing Business in China. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming James Fallows.
Thank you very much, Dan, for your gracious introduction. Thanks to the Commonwealth Club, the ideal venue in California, for having me, and the World Affairs Council. Thanks to my friends and family members and other members of the community who've come here. It's a real delight to be back in my original home state of California. I'm from the southern part, which I know has cultural differences with the north, but still I feel as if I'm back home. I'm also delighted to have the opportunity to explain what I was trying to do in this book, China Airborne, why it was an exciting enterprise for me to undertake, and what I was trying to explain about the ways to think about China itself, about American relationships with China, and other things that I, over the last 6 years, while my wife, who is here, and I have been mainly living in China, have learned about this fast-growing part of the world. What I'm going to do, the plan for the next 28 minutes or so, in which I'm going to be talking before our questions and conversation, I have three main things I'm going to do. First, I'm going to describe why it was that I thought the most effective way I could tell the stories about China that I think are interesting was through this medium of looking at one aspect of its high-tech ambitions. I found myself unexpectedly getting into worlds that I hadn't been looking for when we first got there, and I thought that this was a way that it had surprising benefits in explaining what China is doing. There is a fact about writing books. How many people here, by chance, have written books? Some, you know, a significant number. How many intend to? A larger number. There is one. The main bit of advice I can give you about writing books is that you should only do a certain book if you feel you simply have to do it, because otherwise the process is so discouraging, so soul-eroding, so corrosive of all the good things of life that you will find other things to do along the way. You begin thinking, why is it I'm spending 8 hours a day or more sitting in what one of my friends called the lonely agony of the writer's den, just cranking these things out? The answer to that question is not simply that you feel better having done it than you felt bad while doing it, but more that there is something where you feel as if you can explain things to a readership and to yourself, you'll feel satisfied. So I felt as if there was a part of reality that nobody else had captured that I had a chance to chronicle. So part one is going to be the approach that led to this book with, as you will see, the delightful propaganda poster cover of having these cultural revolution era people looking idealistically at the sky. It's a very, very different China now from the time of that poster, but something about the spirit of that image is what I was going to trying to portray. The second thing I'm going to do then is talk about some of the larger currents underway in China affecting its development, affecting the rest of us that come together in this chronicle I'm telling in the book, and ones which are positive in their implications, ones which are more mixed in their implications, and some that are bad. But why various aspects of China's high-tech ambitions are significant for the larger themes running through modern China that it's trying to resolve. Then, finally, I'm going to talk about some of the big contemporary questions for China per se, some of the recent items that have been in the news, the trend of U.S.-Chinese relations, and what we can expect for those after this presidential election and the change of power in China. So that is the plan. First, about the background of this book. Second, about the themes of China that I found myself self-discovering over the last 6 years and tried to lay out. And then third, about China in the larger sense, how we should think about what is changing, what we know and what we don't know, the don't know being an important part to make middle room for. That's the agenda. The reason I ended up writing this book is that when my wife and I first arrived in Shanghai just about 6 years ago, beginning what was a three-plus-year on-scene stint at that time and then several return visits, and we're going back again in about 10 days, is that I found myself looking through magazine articles and other sorts of reports on radio and other ways, trying to convey some of the things which were most different about being there on scene compared with what I had read about China over the years. The main advantage, the main philosophy of a magazine like The Atlantic is to have our reporters go around the world and tell you things that are different if you're there from what you'd think just reading about at a distance. I recognize there is a closed-loop paradox to this because we also are writing things for people to read at a distance, but still, that's the arbitrage we apply. What do you realize mainly by being there? And some of the features that I wanted to convey about China's scale and diversity, one was simply the energy of things. That every day you go on a car ride, ride a bike, you take a bus ride, you go on an airplane trip, and you see something you simply hadn't imagined the morning before. Almost every evening around the dinner table in our apartments in Shanghai or Beijing or around the other provinces of China, my wife and I would say, "You won't believe X that I saw today." And the "you won't believe" part was constant each day. The X had a different value each day too, but that was the kind of excitement I wanted to convey. I wanted to convey more generally a sense of two paradoxes about China for American readers in particular, which was how they could feel responsible for taking China seriously and paying attention to what is going on there for good and bad without being afraid of it, without thinking that it was necessarily world-mastering and all-conquering. It's truly absorbing and truly worth paying attention to, even if you don't think it's going to be the master of America's economic fate or opposing its new ideological order on the world. I also wanted to convey to American readers the fact that contradictory things of every sort are true simultaneously in some part of China. The way in which if somebody asks you, is it controlled? You say yes. Is it uncontrolled? Yes. Is it good? Yes. Is it bad? Yes. Is it modern? It's you know the sequence I'm going down. And finding ways to allow mental room for some of the range that is such a vivid factor of modern China was also one of my ambitions. I'll give you one little anecdote about the kinds of contradictions I was trying to get across. We were in Beijing in the run-up to the Olympics over that year and then the year or so after that, and we saw the ways in which the country was simultaneously optimistic and fearful about showing itself off to the outside world. For example, in the 2 months before the Olympic Games, the Chinese Foreign Ministry authorized a series of protest zones around Beijing where these would be authorized and legitimate. People could come and air their grievances, and the world's press would see, oh, yes, China is becoming tolerant in this way. So the Foreign Ministry is doing this. Simultaneously, the Chinese security authorities are denying all requests for authorized protest and arresting most of the people who apply. So both those things are true, people trying to open up, people trying to close down. And so the challenge is how to capture that. I ended up thinking that for people in the communications business, it was important to have a simultaneously multi-track policy on trying to convey this reality. One track is the view from above, the macro big picture, where you would say, here's an article or a book or a TV series about pollution in China, or about China's financial might around the world, or about the future of Chinese industry, or women in China, or whatever. That's important. I've done some of those. You've all read those. The other thing which is valuable in my experience is the micro view, because there are so many particular stories, people, provinces, successes, failures in China that tell the world about what is going on there. And they also can be very, very valuable. For example, a family plug here. My wife, who is a linguistics person, did a wonderful book last year called Dreaming in Chinese. And her leitmotif was to say, if you immerse yourself in the Chinese language, what is it you learn about China more generally by the things that are similar and different from other languages? There's a book I love called Foreign Babes in Beijing. It's by a young American who became a famous soap opera villainess/slut on a very popular Chinese TV drama, and what she learned by becoming a pop star in Beijing. And there's so our library on China material is partly big picture, partly precise picture. I thought, as the months went by, that I had a very vivid microcosm tale to relate, because these are people who nobody else in the outside, in the Western press, had ever met or written about. And cumulatively, their stories really did tell you something about where their entire country was going. I'll give you a couple of illustrations of the kind of characters I found myself meeting month after month after month that populate this book and the landscape they seem to inhabit of what is going on in the country. For example, one of the characters earlier in my book is a man whose family name is Xu, X-U. He grew up in Shanghai. He left China not exactly as a political emigre, but as somebody looking for more opportunities in the early 1990s when he was in his 20s then after the Tiananmen upheavals. He got to New York. He had some kind of student role there. He was appalled on landing at Kennedy Airport in New York, not for the reasons you would normally be appalled there, but for recognizing the taxi fare to his university dormitory exhausted almost all the cash he had in his entire assets. So he got a job that night. He got another job the next morning. He continued his studies. Over 20 years, he became very, very rich. And he decided after a while, about 5 years ago, to return to China, where he now, in addition to being a coal baron, runs something called the Western Returned Scholars Association. Actually, I'm going to see him again next week in Shanghai. But the reason I introduce him is that a vivid, vivid memory for him of his time in America when he was on a fishing trip, a commercial day fishing boat in Long Island Sound. And the people all around him were casting their lines into the water of Long Island Sound. And on a back cast, somebody leaned back and a giant three-pronged hook got into somebody else's eye on the boat. And this was panic and despair and moaning and everything else. But Mr. Xu noticed that the captain came to them and said, "Do not panic. Do not be afraid. We know that in less than 8 minutes, the Coast Guard helicopter will be here. The man will be taken to safety, etc." So Mr. Xu watched his timepiece. 7 minutes, 45 seconds, the Coast Guard helicopter arrives. They lift the man out, and they learn later that not only has his eye been saved, but he's in entirely good health. And Mr. Xu thought to himself, "In my country, this man would die." And so as he amassed his fortune and prepared to go back to China, his dream was, "Someday I will bring to my country rescue helicopters. I'll be able, if people are injured in traffic crashes or whatever, or if they have their eyes gouged by fishing hooks, there will be a way they can be saved." And you find across the territory of China people with these half-lunatic but half-ambitious and serious dreams that they are applying in arenas beyond aerospace and aviation, but in this one too. So Mr. Xu is now also, in addition to being head of the World Western Return Scholars Association, he has a big helicopter company. He's trying to get helicopters. He's selling them to the police. He's selling them to businessmen and all the rest. I met a man in Xi'an, a city that we all know for the terracotta warriors, but also Xi'an is famous in China as the site of its aerospace industry. The reason why there are 250,000 aerospace employees in Xi'an is something obvious only in the context of Chinese strategic history. Chairman Mao put the aerospace industry there because in the 1950s he decided this is the point in the Chinese landmass that is farthest from the closest foreign border and therefore hardest to bomb by the Russians, by the Americans, by the Japanese, or anybody else. So you have in the middle of the country, you have this 250,000 person encampment of aerospace technology making parts for Boeing, for Airbus, and others. But the man who's in charge of all of this took me into his office a couple of years ago after touring his facilities and showed me these two statues that are by his desk that he draws inspiration from each day. One is of Deng Xiaoping, the man, of course, who liberalized the Chinese economy over the past 30 years. He said that if it were not for Mr. Deng, I would be in a rice paddy today. I would be impoverished. The other one was of George Washington. And he said, well, George Washington could have been king and decided not to. And this is an example to China, and more people should take this seriously. I met a man who grew up in rural, in the Midwest of the United States and worked for Boeing as a safety inspector around the world. He was a European specialist, and he was on some assignment in Francophone Europe about 25 years ago when they said, how would you like to go to China? And he said, well, not very much, but because he didn't speak Chinese, he was already middle-aged, et cetera. But they said, if you want to be protected against layoffs, the part of the world where the workflow is likely to be strongest is going to be in China. So he decided to go to China. He became first a Boeing representative, then an FAA representative in China. Now he spends most of his time in a Chinese office building speaking in Chinese with people he's trying to train to have air traffic systems that are safer than the ones in the past in China that bring – he's been part of the movement that's been entirely unpublicized of mainly American but also international figures who over the last 15 years have embedded themselves in the fabric of China's transportation infrastructure, saying, if you want to bring this to international standards, here's the way you can do it. There's a whole list of other people. I'll just give you two other brief mentions of the characters that I was describing. One was a very seedy-seeming salesman of business jets. Now, maybe business jet salesmen are like this as a category, but this guy seemed as if he would have been Sidney Greenstreet's, would have played him if it were some movie of the Humphrey Bogart era. And this was at the Hong Kong Air Show about a year and a half ago, where he was selling business jets to ambitious Chinese millionaires, mainly from southern China. At the time, there was no place they could fly them, because the airspace in China was still very tightly controlled. At the time, they didn't really know what they're going to do with them, but they thought it would be worth having in their own neighborhood airports as sort of a sign of their magnificence. And I saw one of these transactions conducted in cash with a great big locker full of money. There are parts of the world where a locker full of money would suggest narco-trafficking or whatever else. We know there are corrupt aspects to the Chinese business boom, too, but it's a sign, again, of the scale and the excitement and all the rest. I open the book with a description of one other person who has decided as an outsider to make his way in this Wild West frontier of what's going on in China, a man named Peter Kleiss, who is a linguistic, one of many linguistics whizzes I saw in China. And his role was to sell a kind of airplane called Cirrus. This is some, if any of you are pilots here, you'll know about this. It's now the most popular small airplane in the world. It's the kind that I actually started back in 2000. I bought one of them myself and have flown around it. Little plane with four seats, a single engine, and crucially, a parachute for the entire plane. If things go wrong, you pull a red handle, the parachute comes down. Many, many people have been saved. So Peter Kleiss was selling these in China, again, to people who couldn't use them at the time, but including one businessman who wanted to park it in the lobby of his business so that his mistresses and girlfriends and his business competitors could sit in it and be impressed with his magnificence. And I took a flight with Peter Kleiss as a ferry pilot on one of these planes, which I'll describe later on. But it was a sign of both the ambitions of things happening in China and some of the limitations of the level they are now at. My point, just to bring this first part to a close, is that in our lives of traveling around China, my wife and I had quite a different impression from when we were living in Japan during its boom times of the 1980s. In Japan, you mainly marveled at the system, the organization of the corporations and the schools and the training and the way that individuals were part of a larger system. In China, from my perspective, you mainly marvel at the individuals and the friction among the sort of centrifugal forces around the country, the people with their big dreams who are trying to create aerotopias in the middle of nowhere. And so seeing these people, I thought, there is a tale to tell. Let me now go to the second part of what I'm going to discuss initially, which is some of the larger tensions and developments within China that you see in the microcosm in this aspect of their high-tech ambition, and the plot lines that you follow out here, you could see in almost any other part of what is ambitious and what is frustrated and what is promising and what is not developing in China. One of them, of course, is the nature of the all-out push for modernization in China. People often say, how can the Chinese public put up with some of the constraints and limitations and oppressions of life in China in these days? And I think that the main answer is that over the past 30 years, as people look back 5 years in the past, 10 years in the past, they recognize that their life is much better. Their family's life, their prospects are much better than they were before. And this is thanks to this all-out push the government has been directing and that individual entrepreneurs have been the main engine for. The part of the push that's underway right now is the famous 12th five-year plan. How many of you have studied the 12th five-year plan? I bet some. Within the United States, in the U.S. context, the entire idea of five-year plan sounds preposterous. They're taken seriously in China, and this one in particular because of the change in the curve that it is proposing for the Chinese economy. It says, basically, looking backwards, China's successes have almost all been in low-tech, low-wage factories, building roads, building railroads, and all the rest. In the future, under this plan, they want to have more high-tech. They want an infotech industry, they want a biotech industry, they want a clean-tech energy, and they want at aerospace industry. So the idea that the country can move from its current level of technology to the next is something that's being played out in this industry in a lot of others. Another major theme that you see about China in this field and others is the style of what I think of as the real estate-centric theory of modernization. If you look for an explanation of almost anything that's happening in China now and say, well, why is this seaport going there? Why is this ancient village being removed? Why is X, Y, or Z happening? Real estate deals may not be the only answer, but they're usually the first answer. And it is the case certainly in the huge boom in aerospace construction that's underway in China. I don't know if anyone here knows the actual number of airports being built in the United States now. I've heard two, I've heard one, I've heard zero, I've heard four, but it's a small number. In China, there are 100 airports under construction, which is from a low base. They had many fewer than the U.S. to begin with, but this is a sign both of the idea of building up the infrastructure with the idea that things will follow and also all the intermediate people who are making money as this goes on. Land for the airports, tractors, navigation equipment. Chinese people and foreigners are making this. So this is, you see in this field, anything you've read about ghost cities in China or the land boom, the land bubble, that same plot and that same pressure is underway in their aerospace ambition. You see in this field something that I came to view as very, very important to making sense of China, which is the way that everything is simultaneously true. I mentioned before the way that contradictions exist, but when you think of economic emphases, people have asked me, well, what's the balance between high-speed rail and aviation? What's the balance between more water traffic and more landborne traffic? The answer is more of all of them. There just is this pressure that China is building more high-speed rail than other people, more railroads, more airports, and all of that. There is something I'll just allude to as a major point. It's a large theme in my book, which is the existence of a semi-sovereign power in U.S.-China relations that is hardly ever discussed. And that is not the sovereign nation of the United States or the sovereign nation of the People's Republic of China, but rather the unacknowledged sovereign of the Boeing Corporation. That many of the crucial turning points in China's decisions about what to do have been intermediated, usually in a beneficial way, by Boeing. Here's one illustration. About 15 years ago, and I described this, a major Chinese airline got its first contract to send to have regular flights to California. They were very excited about this. It was a huge opening and also a great mark of prestige. When the first plane landed at LAX, it was suddenly surrounded by safety inspectors from the FAA who just impounded it and said, no, 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 no. You're not going to land here with this kind of a maintenance record anymore. The airline was aghast and shocked. They lost face. They got in touch with Boeing and said, How can we keep buying your fine products if we can't fly them to the United States? Boeing then, very subtly and very effectively, midwifed an arrangement between the U.S. FAA, between flight schools in the United States, people who would do training, and their Chinese counterparts and said, here is the way you run safety systems. You don't have Czech pilots doing inspections for their brother-in-law or their next-door neighbor. You have to have some kind of governance system. And so even today, many things that matter in Chinese aviation are being sort of a tripartite negotiation of China, the United States, and Boeing are the ones that are working these things out. I'll just mention one or two other points that come together in this narrative. You all, one is the environment. Any of you who've been in China know firsthand what the rest of you know theoretically, that environmental challenges are, in my mind, the worst problem for China and the worst challenge the nation faces in its drive to modernize. This, of course, affects aviation because while flights are in some ways resource savings, it's more efficient to have flights to remote Western China than to build railroads there. Of course, emissions from aviation are an important climate issue because they come out at such high altitude. So therefore, as in other environmental areas, there's a balance in China between how terrible things are and how hard the government and private industries are trying to improve them. In aviation, this shows up both in good ways. For example, a huge research project run by Boeing and the Qingdao Provincial University on algae fuel, and also in a very unexpected way, where one of the most important environmental barriers to better environmental management in China turns out to be the Chinese military. Almost all in the airspace in China is controlled by the military, and airlines have to take very indirect, contorted, and inefficient routes through this. Many of you know that airliners in the U.S., if you listen to the pilot, they're flying at 30,000 feet, 35,000 feet. Often in parts of their Chinese flight, they'll be flying at 10,000 feet, which is a much, much less efficient way for airliners to operate. It's because of military regulations. And many people have argued to me that Chinese airlines could double their traffic with no increase in emissions if simply they got rid of all the military control of the airspace, allowed them to fly the same kind of efficient routing. So there is the environmental issue, there's the military issue, and there's one other point that I'll mention here, which is the surprising parallel between the openness and the closeness of Chinese life to outsiders. Something I liked very much about living in China was the way it seemed permeable and accessible. There was always a way to do something. If you had a friend, if you had a new friend, if you applied some surprising approach, you could find ways to do most things, even as authorized protest zones were, in fact, leading to people being arrested and all the other problems we know about the closedness of Chinese life. That happens, too, in this aerospace world, where you find, in some ways, the foreign presence is very, very tightly integrated in Chinese life, and others it is on its own. So just to bring the second part to an end before a very brief third, almost all the dramas that are underway now in China about whether it can modernize, whether it can save the economy, the balance between central direction and local boosterism, which is so powerful in this field as in others, the ways in which it's connected to outside standards and not, these tensions are also being reflected in the aerospace world. Let me now move briefly, just for two or three minutes, to talking about China itself. And I will confine myself to a point about China, a question about China, and a point about China and the United States. I think a fascinating question, a crucial question for China, one that really is the one that lies behind this book, but even beyond the importance of this book, it's important for China too, which is whether China is ever going to be something different from what it is. Here's what I mean. If you look back over 30 years in China, you see a place that is unrecognizably different in countless ways. I was first there in the mid-1980s with my family in circumstances I'll tell you about if you ask. It was a very different place. We were followed when we went around places. Our rooms were surveilled. It was you had to get kind of contrived visas to get in there. There were very few lights at night. Now, of course, it is different. But it's different in a way that some Chinese and foreign people think is reaching a limit. that a development model based on these low-wage factories where they make the iPad I hold in my hands, if this costs $500, only $50 stays in China. Is that a formula for them to get rich in the long run? It's one thing to assemble products for Apple, a different thing to have your own Apple that you are developing. So it's on low-wage manufacturing. It's on this infrastructure investment. It's on construction of new cities and things all around the world. And that may be nearing its limit. Even in China, there's only so many airports you can build, only so many new 10 million person cities you can build, only so many new seaports. And there is a fear of China's entering what's called the lower income trap, of becoming a bigger and more intense version of itself, but never really becoming rich. And that is under active debate by everybody in the Chinese economic leadership, saying, if we look ahead 30 years, do we imagine ourselves more like Germany, like Japan, like the United States, or do we imagine ourselves more like Mexico or another middle power that has developed in certain ways but hasn't become rich thoroughly? And that is one huge question that runs through the current Chinese reaction to its economic tensions and also to the political problems we see in the Bo Xilai case and Cheng Guangcheng with his dissident role. The reason those matter, the reason these political cases matter, is the following interesting connection. If we look back 20 or 30 years, we know the people who said so confidently that as China prospers, it will democratize, they were wrong. China has prospered and has democratized very little. It is much more liberal than it was before, but is not more democratic. But a different version of that question may apply in the 30 years ahead, which is the question whether China can become rich if it does not become more liberal, if it doesn't allow more free research, more free press, more free internet or whatever. That is one question about China. It's the main one in addition to the environmental one to consider. The question about the United States involves how we use the Chinese example. Something I believe very strongly is that the things that are right about America and that are wrong about America have almost nothing to do with China. The main connection, in my view, is that what is most right about America is its ability to attract and exploit an outsized share of talent from around the world. Many of these people are Chinese. I say I'm glad to have them here. I'm even glad to have them trained here and go back to China because that has long-term beneficial influence in my view. So I think that what is good about America is not directly related to China. What's bad about America also, in my view, is not China's fault at all. It's our own responsibility for how our income is distributed, for how our political system works, and all the rest. But the challenge for us with China is to see whether for another 20 or 30 years we can manage the same situation we've had so far, which is to say that we welcome, support, and can tolerate the emergence of a poor country as it moves up in both economic and diplomatic influence around the world without feeling directly threatened by that, but while simultaneously recognizing the ways in which we disagree on strategic issues, on political value issues, and all the rest. And so I think there has been significant success by both the leaderships of China and the United States over the last 30 years in managing this relationship so that it has not blown up and so that this huge shift in world power hasn't caused more conflict than it has. A challenge on both sides is whether that is possible for the 30 years further on. There is more I can say on a lot of these points, but I think for now I will say that's my opening pitch. I wrote this book because I thought I've seen something in my role as pilot in China that most people don't know about and that is revealing because it has a cast of characters. I think that all the things that are interesting within China about how it modernizes institutional relationships, central-provincial relationships, increases in liberty in that, and similar factors are in this drama too. And finally, there are large-scale tensions for China in its development and for our relations with it, which I hope this sheds some light on, and I'll be happy to discuss with you further. So thanks for listening to this part of my presentation. I'll be happy to hear the questions that Jonathan Weber, my former boss at the Industry Standard, where is Jonathan? Yes, Jonathan was my editor at the Industry Standard long ago, and he's going to join me up here. So thanks for listening, and I'll look forward to your questions.
Well, thanks, thanks, Jim, and thanks to the Commonwealth Club for presenting this forum. As Jim mentioned, we were colleagues back when, and in fact, I've been a Jim Fallows fanboy for pretty much my entire career. And it was a great privilege to have him work at the Industry Standard. And what I especially appreciated, actually, was that when I managed to convince Jim to come on board after a stint from Microsoft, one of my hopes was that he would be a bit of a role model for the very young staff that we had there. And he accomplished that in spades, and I've always been greatly appreciative of that. So thank you, Jim.
It was a great time. Jonathan was a great editor, and the magazine went from being the fattest magazine in the history of the world to not being around a year later. But it was great while we were there.
That's right. Rapid rise and fall. So I thought there's a lot of kinds of topics we could discuss, and I thought I'd start out by asking what I think is one of the core questions relating to American relationship to China and especially business relationship to China, and is certainly a core part of the book. And that has to do with how American companies and especially high-tech companies or companies with intellectual property can and should relate to their Chinese counterparts. And you talk a lot about Boeing's enormous role and the role of certain individuals in building up the aerospace industry and very close relationship of Boeing and other companies to their Chinese counterparts. And that, you know, a cynic would say that that's idiotic and that they're just essentially giving away their competitive edge, and 15 years from now, the Chinese companies will put them out of business. I mean, how do you think about that?
Consistent with my past policies, I think all parts, all attitudes are correct about this problem. I think, and let me talk about it first in the general terms and then in the sort of Boeing GE specific situation. The Chinese economy over the last 30 years, like the Japanese economy after World War II and like the U.S. economy from about 1840 to about 1890, took significant advantage of other people's developments and piggybacked on them. If you read Charles Dickens's diaries from his travels to America, he was just furious about all these pirated versions of his books that he saw in the United States, very much like the pirate videos you see in China now. And this is an unfortunate but familiar trait of a catch-up economy. So that's point one. Point two is it is both a legitimate role of U.S. governmental policy and also something for corporate strategy to put pressure on the Chinese to change these practices. And so, for example, 2 weeks ago during the big strategic and economic dialogue between the U.S. and China in Beijing, which was overshadowed by the Chun case, one of the deals that the U.S. was pushing harder for was a different kind of intellectual property regime and more enforcement from the Chinese officials. So this is something where the outside world needs to keep pushing. Here's a sign of progress or not, depending on how you feel. You know, in China, I have an actual genuine Timex watch here, but when I was living in China, I had these $5 Rolexes and all. A difference between Hong Kong and mainland China is that in mainland China, they'll say, oh, here, buy a Rolex. In Hong Kong, with its British inheritance of rule of law, the hawkers have to say, fake Rolex, fake Rolex. So at least there is transparency in labeling. So it is a problem. I think that corporations must be hyper-vigilant about this. And I'll get to an aviation illustration in a second. But also recognize that in the long run, China is going to be trapped itself if it can't solve this problem for its own corporations, because it won't have its own pharmaceutical companies, its own corporations of any sort with international brand value if they can't be protected against their own people. So I think that's why the solution of this low-wage trap issue is so interesting, because if China is to solve it and become the kind of country that has its own Boeings, its Apples, its GEs, its Rolexes, that will suggest a lot of other changes in how China has done its business. And so that is an important point. Finally, on aviation, I think the crown jewels of aviation intellectual property are actually the engines. So I think GE, Pratt & Whitney, and Rolls-Royce are properly thinking all the time about how they can do what they must to do some of their work inside China, but also to keep their most important work safe, much as Intel has tried to do, opening chip plants in China, but not its very frontline chip plants.
And have they been properly vigilant in your view?
As they say, time will tell. but I think they are certainly hyper aware of this. And right at this moment, I think the aerospace analysts would think that the Chinese aviation industry is extremely weak in engine technology. Now, whether they still think that 20 years from now is a different matter, but the ambition of GE, Rolls-Royce, and Pratt & Whitney is to keep that gap in place for a long time. Again, if China succeeds in this, it will suggest that a lot of other things have been solved, too, and have changed.
Mm-hmm. Now, on that point about other things being solved and other things changing, and intellectual property, rule of law are kind of good examples, and that plays into an idea that you mentioned earlier, that somehow in order for China to become a wealthy country, it has to be sort of more Western in a way, for lack of a better word. And do you think that is in fact happening, or do you think it's true and do you think it's happening?
The way I'd put the version I think of as true is this, that in the West we're used to thinking of democracy and liberalization as being part of one package. You know, there is liberal democracy, and we think that's how things are. I think China's emergence suggests how they can be analytically and practically separated. You know, China is really the only major country where the people have no vote in their national leadership now. On the other hand, it has become much more liberal than it was a generation ago. People can travel much more and they can read more things, although still too few. So I think that these liberal values, it's interesting that if you look at the countries that are now rich, they differ in lots of ways, but they all have a certain number of social traits. They respect the role of free universities and of free press and of free speech and of independent research and of intellectual property protection and that kind of thing. So that bundle of traits, you know, what Max Weber would have talked about of sort of the cultural basis of capitalism, I think that is something to become rich. China will need to manifest more of that, and we'll see whether that is possible.
And in terms of recent trends, say, over the last couple of years and with the current leadership change and the somewhat bumpy, I guess you could say politely, leadership change, do you think it's heading in that direction, or is there a chance that it's essentially going to reverse? I mean, people talk about a left-right split and the old Maoist, you know, Bozhilai being a sort of a Maoist and there being a comeback of that. I mean, is that a possibility that we'll essentially see a tightening of control as opposed to liberalization?
Yes, I think almost any hypothesis is possible. I will refrain from reading the eloquent final page of my book, which is a plea for why it is so difficult to be sure of what is going to happen here. But let me give one of the most recent indicators of uncertainty. If you look back over 30 years, you can see that there are variations up and down in all of the things you've been talking about of liberties within China, a kind of a more predictable government. There are variations up and down, but the trend has been positive. Over 2 and 3 year periods, things have gotten more normal, more liberal, more not Western, but less communist sort of autocracy and arbitrary rule. In the last 3 years or so, I think they've gone in reverse. And there's been a kind of, I describe in my book, a condition of permanent emergency where there's always some special circumstance that requires cracking down, whether it's the Olympics or the Shanghai Expo or the Arab Spring or Bozhilai. So what nobody knows is whether this is a 3-year blip and the moving average is still going up or whether this is a turn. And I hope it's not a turn, and I think most people in China also hope it's not a turn, but it could be a turn. I think there are part of the tension you see in the new leadership struggle is people with different views about what's most wrong with China. There are some people who say that what's most wrong with China is that you have all these billionaires, like the guy I saw in a golden Bentley in Beijing, and the guy I saw him moving past who was pulling an ox cart with his shoulders. So there are people who say there's too many billionaires and too many people who are being left behind. Other people say what's most wrong with China is the stuff I'm talking about, that it still is too arbitrary. It's not becoming rich and modern in a deep sense. So these things, as we speak, are being played out and contended over.
And would it be fair to think about that as sort of, in crude terms, a left-right split? I mean, is that a useful...
I think it is a... You could think of it that way. I think that probably misleads Americans more than it correctly leads them, because you know, the joke by a lot of my friends in Beijing was that the only communist in China was the Cuban ambassador to Beijing, who was always writing these public letters criticizing China for its revisionism and how could a Lamborghini dealership be reconciled with the teachings of Marx, et cetera. So it's, I think that we can call it left-right, but the kinds of left and right are so at odds with what we have in mind that I've tried to avoid that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you think Americans and, I mean, America should fear China? And in particular, you know, there was a wave of sort of fear of Japan. And someone else had asked this question. There was great fear of Japan at one point. That turned out to be misplaced. Now there's sort of fear of China. Do you think, A, how does that compare to the – how does the Japan and then and China now situation compare? And secondly, is sort of fear and worry a good response?
Let me say something about Japan, something about the phenomenon of fear, then something about fearing China. I think two of the most different countries I've ever been in are Japan and China. You know, there are obvious some similarities in religious heritage and character-based writing system and all that, but in terms of just their look and feel and operations, they are really different. A metaphor I often thought of when being in Japan was it's like living inside a watch where everything is so tightly machined that you admire its precision, but there's not a lot of extra room for you. Mm-hmm. Whereas China is like living in a giant, you know, rugby scrum where there's always something new to be done. And I think when it comes to this matter of competition, I still think that the Japanese technological and corporate competition over the last 25 years was actually more threatening to the United States than China, despite the differences in scale, because you had these head-to-head national champions. You know, you had Toshiba and Toyota and Sony, and there's no counterparts for those in China. So Japan is still a rich country. It's had political catastrophes of its own. So Japan and China I view as really different situations, and I think there was reason to be more fearful of Japan. Second, on the phenomenon of fear itself, I did an article about 2 years ago for The Atlantic after moving back from China trying to ask seriously, are we going to hell? You know, America, are we falling apart? And one of the interesting things for me from historians is that America has always craved the specter of imminent collapse as a way of doing business. The first sermon on the decline of America delivered on U.S. soil was in 1630. And it was about, you know, in 1620, things were great, but now, you know, kids today have lost their values. And so it is part of how we are that we need these senses of imminent decline. It may mean that we're actually going to decline at a certain point, but it's part of our propulsive nature. I think if foreign challenges can be used in a constructive way, as saying, if the Chinese can build this wind energy plant, why can't we do it too? That's fine. If it's in a menacing way of we're about to be of lackey slaves of the Chinese, I think that is not useful. Finally, fearing China. China has so many more problems than the U.S. that you wouldn't know where to start. And I think that for people who've spent much time in the interior of China, the idea that the U.S. should be afraid of a country which has more poor peasants than we have people, and which has environmental problems you can't imagine, and where a party boss told me a couple of years ago something that stayed in my mind. He says, you Americans think of everything in China multiplied by 1.3 billion. We think of everything divided by 1.3 billion. And so I think we should not be afraid of China, but we should take it seriously.
Mm-hmm. So the book obviously, it's about aviation, and there's a lot of special characteristics about the aviation industry that are unique. And I wonder if you think that the way in which other industries have evolved in China is comparable or different, and if so, different in what way?
I was using aerospace and aviation as an example of a group of a category I describe as apex industries, and I'll explain why I call them that and how they're different from what's gone before. The development that's happened so far in China has been amazingly mediated by outside companies and outside investors. You know, lots of investors in China. If you looked at Japan during its industrialization, it was very, very hard for outside corporations to invest there. If you go to China and all the big factories, they're American, they're German, they're Korean, some of them are Japanese. So there's been this externally financed factory boom and, as I said, construction boom and all the rest, which has gotten them to a certain point. The significance of the kind of industries and corporations that China does not have are ones like pharmaceuticals or like world popular or certain kind of internet applications and aerospace too, because to succeed in those industries, I call them apex industries because there's a whole substructure of successes you have to have worked out. Certain kinds of research institutions, certain kind of quality standards, political-military relations, and all the rest. So aerospace, clean energy, pharmaceuticals, high-end infotech, these are things that the Chinese want to develop and haven't yet. And so I think that the reason I was using this industry as a specimen is I think it is a very representative specimen for all of its kind of odd traits of the target that the planners of the 12th five-year plan and the 13th and 14th beyond that have in view.
So when you look at the way the specifics of how aerospace is developing and you talk of this big center around Xi'an, how does that compare with the early development of the aerospace industry in the U.S.? Los Angeles, especially.
The origins of aerospace in the U.S. and China could not be more different in that there have been every factor in the U.S. created to this diverse ecology where, of course, there was an industry in Los Angeles, but also in Wichita and also in New York and also in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. So in the U.S., we had the simultaneous emergence of lots of entrepreneurs in the early 20th century, the Wright brothers and then everybody who followed them. We had a multiplicity of funding sources. The Army Air Force was the first big purchaser for the Wright brothers, but also the Postal Service did the most effective industrial planning or industrial policy in the U.S. by having airmail pilots and saying this is going to be the market for airplanes. We had individual barnstormers. We had airports all over the place. So we had a very, very rich structure. In China, this has been military from day one. And so airspace was controlled and was militarily secret. It's amazing to go to big Chinese cities. They're extremely noisy, but not noisy from overhead. Not helicopters, despite Mr. Xu's best efforts, not airliners, because the airports are usually far away. And so it's the effort, almost like the Russian-Soviet economy, of going from a military-run system, trying to will it into the civilian world. And that's what trying to liberalize something by central government fiat, it's a trick, but something the Chinese have learned, gotten used to over the last 30 years, and this is a really interesting test case for them.
Mm-hmm. So do you think some of the things that have been done, you talk of all these airports, right? Airports and the giant airports in the middle of nowhere. Do you think that those are going to be real airports, or do you think 20 years from now they'll look like silly white elephants?
The white elephant category in China is a very heavily populated one, as you all know. You've seen these slideshows of cities that could hold 2 million people and actually are holding no million people or no people. It's worth recognizing that even by their mere existence, they've served an important role for China and that people have been at work building these things. It's also the case that infrastructure in China has been underbuilt so far, so the overbuilding they're assuming will be caught up sooner or later. The United States has about 5,000 airports across its landmass, of which about 100 plus are suitable for sort of big commercial airliners. China has only fewer than 500 airports of any kind whatsoever. So they're trying to ramp that up. A lot of these things look like completely wacky local booster projects. I describe one of them where people in the equivalent of Elko in Nevada or someplace, built this huge runway with the idea they're going to attract the concurrence of Silicon Valley and Disney World and Universal Studios and Seattle Boeing factories all in the one place. They're probably not going to do that. But I think the idea is there is so much pent-up demand for motion of people that there will be some take-up of the slack. And in the meantime, they're creating jobs. So it's a kind of communist Keynesianism in its finest form.
Is there, as best you can tell, grassroots enthusiasm for a lot of this? I mean, you talk about kind of the general enthusiasm in China about the future and kind of joy at the prospects. Does that really extend to the, you know, broadly and specifically about aviation? So if you talk to a peasant, would they say, yeah, you know, we're going to have airplanes, or do they not really care?
Some of them would say that. I describe a man I met in the Hong Kong air show a year and a half ago, the same place where I saw a business jet bought with a suitcase full of cash. This was a guy who had probably in his late 50s had suffered during the Cultural Revolution. He said he had always dreamed of being a pilot when he was a little boy, but he failed what he called the body exam, and I didn't ask him what exactly that meant. So he became a welder in some Chinese industry, and he ended up making a whole ton of money selling structural steel for floral exhibitions around China. And there are enough of these that he could become very rich. And he now is building his own airplanes, you know, himself in his machine shop, and flying them around northeast China in the Manchuria area. And he was buying his own Cirrus airplane, which is a couple $100,000 airplane down at the Hong Kong Air Show. And he was thinking, my childhood dream has come true. I would say that in the variety of a country of a billion-plus people, there's a whole lot of cynicism, a whole lot of jadedness, a whole lot of what the Chinese call eating bitterness, of putting up with hardship. But the kind of cockeyed optimism that was also often described about America of the early 20th century, you see more of now in more Chinese people than I think you do here, maybe not here in Silicon Valley, but in America as a whole, of people thinking, saying the sentence, my dream is, and however the sentence ends may vary, but there is this my dream is X feeling among a lot of people, mm-hmm. which is fun. It's fun to be part of.
Mm-hmm. So one very good question that came from the audience, when you read the book and read about these things, and you talk about a lot about the entrepreneurs and these guys who have created things from nothing through all these dreams, but it is in fact almost all guys. What is the role of and prospects yes. for female entrepreneurs in China?
So I think that in the Chinese, anybody who spent time in China recognizes that Chinese women are the dominant force in Chinese society, not structurally, but just in terms of force of will and force of personality and cunning and all the rest. So in many, many times you'll find Chinese businesses, not big corporations, but small ambitious ones where women have a role there. In terms of political representation, they're underrepresented even by U.S. standards, and there are lots of there's, of course, discrimination against girl babies versus boy babies and all the rest. So I think aviation has been around the world a largely male pursuit. I describe China's most famous female pilot, who is she's a real piece of work. I'll say one thing about her. She's probably in her mid-40s now. She is pictured in sort of lots of Kim Kardashian-type poses with airplanes in the background. She travels in the company of her teenage son so that she can always say, this is my son. Most people think we are siblings. And the poor kid rolls his eyes, and I think he's going off to Deerfield next year, and he's thinking, he's counting the days before he is out of this world. But aviation is mainly a male world. But I think the texture of Chinese society is very importantly female in its strength, ingenuity, and just charm and warmth.
And do you think we'll see the emergence of prominent female entrepreneurs in China?
Yes. It was the case a couple of years ago that the richest person in China was a woman who had a big sort of scrap recycling business. There's a woman named Hu Shu Li, who probably has appeared here, who's a very, very important factor in journalism in China and finding ways as an entrepreneurial journalist. So, yes, I think we'll see more and more prominent women playing roles of all sorts in China, including as entrepreneurs.
Okay. So last question, which is the card has here, sorry, big question. So with that preface, what do you think is the most important thing for today's American high school students to understand about China?
Let me think how to answer that. I think that they should learn to feel comfortable with it. By that, I don't mean learn to knuckle under to it, learn to revere it, necessarily learn the language, although it's easier when you're a high schooler, but rather to feel at ease with rather than threatened by a world in which China plays a large part. I think one of the best things for China is that so many of its people have studied in the United States, so that either they stay here, which is good for us, or they go back to China, which I think is good both for China and the United States because they are acculturated in certain ways. So I think if American high school students could find ways, including spending time on scene there sometime in their teens or 20s, find a way to spend some months or year there just so they're comfortable with it and recognize that in their world this is going to be a factor, not that it has one that has to be their main business or they have to learn about defensively, but just making it an accepted and natural part of their mental universe. That, I would say, is the most important thing for young Americans to do.
Mm-hmm. Great. So we'll end with a compliment comment on one of the cards.
Thank goodness.
As a longtime reader of your work in The Atlantic and a listener on NPR, it is a pleasure to hear you in person, and I would second that. So thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a real honor to be here, and I appreciate, Jonathan, your great moderation, and thank you all for coming on a beautiful evening.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we'd like to thank James Fallows, author of China Airborne. We'd like to thank Jonathan Weber, West Coast Bureau Chief of Reuters, our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.